Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
Oh, and you can feel the piece of Red Skull's conference room about to be shattered. But let's find out what's the big lowdown on this one, Hal. It sounds like we're going to have some folks dropping in.
I think we are. There's a lot going
Company's
on.
Coming.
Yes, company's coming. Put your company manners on. Sweep everything under the couch. All right, minute 96. In the Red Skull's vast office at Hydra headquarters, Steve Rogers, bloodied but defiant, faces the Red Skull's sneer. Of course you can, of course, the Red Skull says, raising his futuristic ray gun to Steve's head. But unfortunately, I am on a tight schedule. Three steel bolts slam into the frame above the office's giant windows. The Howling Commandos soar in on zip lines. Steve grins. So am I. The Red Skull fires, but Steve yanks a Hydra captor into the path of the energy bolt, which vaporizes the soldier instantly. Three commandos, Gabe, Falsworth, and Dugan, crash through the windows, glass shattering. Gabe and Falsworth unleash a hail of machine gun fire, cutting down Hydra soldiers in the room. Steve hurls his other captor to the ground. The Red Skull bolts, sprinting down a corridor. Dugan and Falsworth mop up the remaining Hydra troops. Rogers, you might need this, Falsworth shouts, tossing Steve his vibranium shield. Thanks, Steve calls, catching it and racing after the Red Skull down another corridor. In a parallel hallway, dozens of Hydra troops march in tight columns until an explosion rips through. Jim, Marita, and Dernier burst in, weapons blazing. Jim speaks into a headset radio. We're in. Assault team, go. Outside in the forest, Colonel Phillips, listening on a walkie-talkie, barks orders. Move out. Allied forces charge toward the Hydra base. Move. Keep your spacing. Blue energy bolts streak through the ranks, vaporizing some troops as they advance.
I can't remember who did it, but someone talked about when they were filming the movie Total Recall. There's the scene with Arnold Schwarzenegger when he's on an escalator and the bad guys are chasing after him and shooting at him, and he grabs a guy on the escalator and uses him as a human shield to absorb all the machine gun bullets that are coming
at him.
And somebody pointed out that guy probably went to Juilliard. He took extra, you know, improv classes. He stayed up late at night. He studied his script. It's like maybe he went to the auditions, and then all of a sudden here he is as cannon fodder. And I keep feeling about that poor that poor servant of Red Skull that gets blasted into blue goo.
Yeah. Well, we interviewed a couple people. We had guests on this show who talked about their audition process, and they had lines and they had character development. They had a whole backstory, and then they show up and, you know, they get shot in the head by Peggy Carter without saying a word.
Exactly. You know,
it happens. I guess it's the business.
Yeah. When I was in high school, I was very good friends with my drama teacher. And he introduced me to a friend of his, and we met up once at Universal when the friend was playing Conan. I almost said Conan the Librarian, but that's a whole other story. Playing the Barbarian in the stage show at Universal. But his first big claim to fame was getting his heart ripped out again by Arnold Schwarzenegger, coincidentally, in The Terminator.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, at least he had lines. But, you know, that was really, it was a fascinating guy to talk to because, you know, you're in Terminator in 1984, you've made it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet, you know, he was not exactly set for life from that role. And he went on to other things. He actually had a kind of a co-starring billing with Sylvester Stallone and Cobra as the villain. But it's an amazing business. And, you know, we pull back the curtain on it from time to time and talk to the people who live it. And it's, you know, it's staggering the amount of work that goes into everybody's piece of it. And also, you know, amazing how you know people who work and work and work and succeed, but they may not be the household names, you know, that a few of them are.
Yeah, I think of from our Rocketeer series, when we had Rick Overton on, And he's a stand-up comedian in his own right, but his big deal in The Rocketeer was getting to point up at the ceiling and go, "It's The Rocketeer."
Right. And he was a shill in the audience on the very first episode of Saturday Night Live, and, yep. and like another 175 credits after that. He, you know, did just fine, but he's, you know, maybe he's not a movie star, but he's
one of those.
So many of these guys are just going to work hard.
Yeah, it's that guy. Yeah, I know that guy.
I was just going to say, there's two great documentaries out about actors who do that. One is called That Guy Who Was in That Thing, and I think the other one is called That Girl Who Was in That Thing. And it's interviews with, you know, a dozen actors who play that kind of role where you see them on the screen, you know you've seen them in 100 things, you don't know their names, but they're having really nice careers just playing a sort of, you know, middling, a lot of them tend to turn out to be like villains. They're because they just got that look about them. But, you know, I think people forget that there are just an awful lot of workaday actors just getting through life just the same as anybody else, except they're on screen.
Exactly. There's a friend of mine from high school, and I like to remind him once every 10 years that he was a couple years behind me in high school. And so he was my understudy on a number of like theater projects and things. And he has, you guys have both seen him 100 times. I will guarantee you that. And he's been, you know, every procedural TV show, you know, and dozens of movies. His IMDb record is a mile long, and he's doing just great. But I don't think you've ever heard of him.
Yeah.
So
it's, I mean, there's, you know, for every, oh gosh, for every Robert Redford, there's a Whit Bissell. So, and if you know who Whit Bissell is, then you're, you know.
I know Whit Bissell,
Whit Bissell. Yeah. I mean, if you see Whit Bissell, then like, if he's in one of the credits, you know this is going to be a great movie.
Right. Didn't you have a vacuum cleaner named after him?
I was going to say the carpet shampooers. That's what I was trying to think of. Yes. I think we've got a Whit Bissell 3000 in the next room. You need to clean up after the cat.
He can travel through time sometimes. Chase giant ants.
Hey, I wanted to ask you guys about the combat planning in this, the strategery, because apparently Cap's plan all along was to be taken to that particular room at that particular time, rather than somehow he knew he wasn't going to be thrown in a dungeon. He knew he wasn't just going to be shot on sight. He had to get taken to that room at that time so that the Howling Commandos could zip line into through the glass. And, man, it raises a couple of questions. How did Steve know this besides plot armor? And what was the whole point of Steve knocking down the front door when the Howling Commandos were just going to zip line through the glass anyway? You know, that plan would have worked just fine without Steve making a ruckus on the other end of the building.
Right. If Steve had just joined them on the zip lines or something like that. And I kind of assumed that Steve wanted to get the Red Skull to do some of the villain monologuing like we've talked about.
I like that.
If I get in and, you know, he's not at no point is Steve ever do anything to suggest, like we've talked about, that he's not pretending he might be turnable. But I do think he's got that in mind, that he's going to get some one-on-one time with Red Skull. And he's read enough into his previous encounters with him that saying, Red Skull is too arrogant to just kill him outright.
I'm just picturing Steve talking to the two Hydra goons, you know, escorting him into the room saying, "Hey fellas, you know, I really like to see that office with the big windows. Do you think you could take me there?"
Exactly.
I'd like to see your boss in his office instead of the dungeon. You think we could you think we could swing by the office?
I mean, you guys are the tour guides, but still, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, and it is this whole thing of the being captured on purpose is kind of a common movie trope. I think of like Skyfall, where Javier Bardem gets captured so that he can get close to M and execute his plot and all that thing. I mean, you think about the Joker in The Dark Knight; he allows himself to be captured by the police because it's a larger scheme to get Harvey Dent and stuff. I hate bringing this up as an example, but Star Trek Into Darkness, where Khan, the guy that doesn't quite look like Ricardo Montalban.
Even a little, yes.
Even a little.
You shut your mouth, Jim.
Yeah. I mean, he surrendered to get taken on board, and then he's going to break out and get control of the ship. And, you know, it's a trope that, I mean, here it's used correctly. It's just, it's a subtle thing, but it's not like, everything doesn't hinge on, the rest of the movie doesn't hinge on this. This is just like one moment in time.
Right. Let's just call it a multi-pronged assault from different directions and let her go with that. Maybe it's not clear to me where, I don't have it open here, where Marita and Dernier come from. We don't see them ziplining in. Maybe they followed Steve in the front door.
Well, he's from Encino, Ace.
Yeah, he came from Encino. That's right. I forgot.
Yeah,
it's a long way from Encino to the Alps, but hey.
Yeah.
Was it Fresno?
It was Fresno.
Fresno. Yeah,
Fresno. It was from Fresno.
Jim's
I'm sorry.
From Fresno. I'm from Fresno.
I would like to talk a little bit about the zipline zipline idea of using a zipline, because I've spent way too much time last night looking stuff up on the internet.
We share.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
lead on, McDuff.
Zip lines, you know, any kind of gravity assisted cable system where you have an inclined plane that you're going to transport people, and usually you're using like, you know, wheels or something on top of it. The first use of it came from about 2000 years ago, and it kind of arose simultaneously in China, India, Japan, and in the Alps around 250 BC. And mostly it's to transport people across rivers or valleys and things like that. In China, in Yunnan, they've been using some of the systems there, the pulleys and rope systems that they've been using, have been used like for thousands of years for crossing rivers because they work. So, you know, if it ain't broke, there's places in Bolivia, the Yungas region of Bolivia, they've been using there for almost 1,000 years, transporting crops across valleys. So they would, you know, instead of having to carry it across a valley, you just kind of pull on a giant clothesline kind of a thing where you slide it across to the other side without having to carry it all. Now there's two different ways of doing things. You have to think about military use, but also recreational use. And I was thinking, well, zip lines are pretty, I mean, I don't remember zip lines when we were kids in like the 70s, 80s or so. There might have been some somewhere, but I don't think that was a common thing.
It seems like that was just a little bit after our time when it became a tourist recreational thing you would go and do. Yeah.
Yeah. But the first recorded, as far as I can tell, the first recorded entertainment use dates to 1739 in England. There was a fellow who was a steeplejack, Robert Cadman. He attempted a descent from the spire of St. Mary's Church in Shrewsbury using a rope and a wooden breastplate with a groove. And the rope snapped and he didn't make it. So.
Oh, no.
Hey, when you said he attempted, and I said, oh.
That's... Yeah. Well, it's, you know, you have to pronounce the attempt. He was brave in the attempt, let's say it that way. But a lot of what they call Tyrolean traverses, slightly inclined rope crossings were built as technical bridges. Basically, these were ski lifts that you had to do yourself. Basically, you hung onto the rope and yanked yourself up without, I mean, they didn't bother with having any kind of mechanical movement of the line.
I was just going to say, it occurs to me you're talking about two different kinds of systems, though, more or less horizontal. And I've seen those for crossing rivers where it's a clothesline, more or less.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah.
But the zip line, the term zip line to me implies some height.
Yeah.
Some,
there's an inclined plane that you're dealing with. You're not dealing with it horizontally. So, a lot of, in World War II, mostly they were used in the Pacific War. Not much in the ETO, but in the Pacific War, they were used to go across challenging landscapes like rivers, ravines, and jungles. The Army actually had kits, zipline kits, so they could, you know, put in rappelling gear and things like that, and knock things into walls and slide stuff out. Wasn't used very much, but they were used in the Pacific, places where there were, you know, volcanoes, mountainous regions and stuff. Mostly they were relied on because they had a minimal infrastructure. You could just set it up. There's just a wire and you just give a guy basically a bike handle and he could slide down it. A lot of the stuff that came out of World War II is now seen in modern zipline engineering. They're still being used militarily, but nowadays most things are relied on require power, so they're available, but they're not hardly ever used. The first use of what we consider, you know, like Brian, we were talking about recreational zipline, where the average Joe could go out in the go up on a hillside and zip down things. It was pioneered by a U.S. biologist, Donald Perry. He built canopy access in Costa Rica's rainforest starting in 1974. So using mountaineering gear and crossbows to shoot lines into the trees and more ropes, he studied the main level of a forest where the biodiversity resides without constant ground returns. So he was actually using it for a purpose. But then people in Costa Rica started saying, hey, you know, this looks like fun. So they started taking over the cables and ropes that he left behind. And they just started swinging between the, you know, Tarzan style. But then by 1979, he noticed that this was going on. So he built a dedicated canopy zip line at Finca La Selva using ropes and pulleys. And one of the things that came about this, he writes it in a book called Life Above the Jungle Floor. It provided tourism in the rainforests of Costa Rica without destruction of the canopy. So you could travel around without going, you know, being down where the alligators and iguanas were, and also you weren't hurting the treetops because it was just below the canopy. So you could go visit and not have to worry about hurting things. There was a commercial course finally set up in 2002 in Haleakala by Skyline Eco Adventures in Hawaii. And that was called Adventure Tourism.
Haleakala.
Yeah, Haleakala. There it is.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I've seen that. I didn't write it, but I've
okay, Haleakala. There you go. Gesundheit. So that opened in 2002, and that started adventure tourism. And apparently, there are lots of companies that track with this based on the experience in Hawaii. They started opening it up in a lot of tropical and island, you know, vacation places that it's considered. Well, where's your zip line now? So the largest zip lines now are available over 3 kilometers long, and you can go at speeds up to 70 miles an hour.
So, I've seen films of those. They're astonishing. Cow. You know, POV, GoPro cameras or something,
yeah.
People doing those kinds of runs. And it's amazing. It looks thrilling, absolutely thrilling. I would do it in a second.
70 miles an hour. That's
70 miles an hour on a wire that I don't know as I don't know what the inspection rate is.
Speaking of the wire, go ahead.
I was just going to say we've seen in the news lately. I hate to go too dark, but there's been a couple of pretty high profile accidents with bungee jumping operators.
Yeah,
and I know it's a bit apples and oranges, but still, you're thinking about any operation like this, you're putting so much trust, as you know, certainly hope it's a reputable outfit. I remember seeing several years ago a place in New Zealand. It looks like this is very big in New Zealand now, as you mentioned, you know, tropical destination kinds of places. But there was one where you hung underneath the line and you were prone. So it was a little bit more of a Superman view was your harness versus, you know, sitting or hanging. And certainly none of the commercial operations rely on the strength of your hands to just hang on and survive. And I hope you make it down. But that looked like that would be pretty spectacular, you know, sort of live out your Superman fix there.
Yeah. And just one last thing, the leader in military, what we're looking at here, the leader in military use of zip lines was Australia. The Australian military history shows that it was used heavily in the New Guinea campaigns during World War II using that. It's Australia kind of is the lead in zip line technology in war. So hopefully these guys had some Australian backing with them when they were doing stuff in World War II.
Yeah, a lot of things occur to me. The first one that applies directly this minute is, I wonder if the firing a piton into a wall of granite is as much a trope as sinking in quicksand or something like that. Like we just assume it always works for Batman. It always works for these guys. How many times do you fire a sharp metal object into a granite wall and have it just bounce off. And what kind of faith do you put in that thing to hold, 200 pounds of man and gear sliding down for half a mile?
Yeah, and what velocity does it have to reach to get into a, solid piece of granite?
I would give that a good tug before I went down that thing.
Yeah,
I had a lot of faith.
I was rewatching For All Mankind on Apple TV the other day, and they have scenes where they're basically they're mining the moon, and that they have to go down inside of craters, and they're doing that thing where they take a piton and shove it into a wall, and all of a sudden, let's hang on that. And even if you're at 1/6 gravity, the moon is mostly dust. It's not rock. So I was like, that's like you said, a lot of faith to put your weight onto it, even if it's 1/6 gravity.
Of course, in real life, you do see people in Yosemite going up El Capitan, held on by one little thing, crammed, hammered into the rock. It's like, gee
Yeah.
whiz. So,
Or free climbing with gloves too. That's another a
well,
little bit beyond
Brian,
that.
speaking of Star Trek V, there you go
Yes, I
again.
know.
That's right there.
No,
Yeah.
no, no.
Hope Spock and his rocket boots are
Yeah, don't forget. Yeah, don't forget your jet
nearby.
boots.
I will just say that perhaps outside of perhaps outside of movies and TV, I'm trying to think of what might have been an early example, but the most vivid example from my first encounter with the concept of the zip line was the very early 70s, the G.I. Joe Adventure Team Training Center. So you had this big tower and all this stuff, this gigantic playset. And what I'd forgotten about was it was common at that time. You saw this with a lot of the Star Wars stuff. Sears often had exclusive versions of these mainstream toys.
Yep.
So it, particularly true with Star Wars, but for the Adventure Team G.I. Joe, if you bought their training center, you didn't get the zip line, but you got a bigger play mat and a different searchlight and stuff. But you'd be kind of screwed out of it if you wanted your Joe to go down a zip line. So you needed the mainstream non-Sears version.
And
But
you
then you
probably did the Sears version have the Kung Fu grip?
got oh yeah. So the Adventure Team at that point was flocked heads and beards, and the hair would immediately depart as soon as you got them in the water. So if you wanted a bald Joe, one trip to the sink. But yeah, we were full into the Kung Fu grip era at that point. And I mean, otherwise, Jim, how do you expect him to hang on to the thing to go down to the zip line? Come on.
Well, if he just
Let's see
does that
you do it
little,
without Kung
it's
Fu
terrible.
grip. Is there?
My hands just went into the 1964 G.I. Joe
I
pattern,
noticed
and
that. We're all doing it right now.
yeah, it's the you got to have the pointing finger in the right hand and
Yes.
the little making the letter C with your left.
Right.
That's so you can
And one of your,
hold the rifle, the M1.
yep, and one of your thumbs has to be backwards for copyright
Yes.
reasons. The thumbnail on the early Joes and the early Hasbro Joes is on the wrong side,
Yes.
Right.
because that was something that Hasbro could copyright to
Yes,
protect
you
against
just brought
knockoffs.
back a probably 60 or more year old memory for me, maybe 55, 60 year old memory of Major Matt Mason,
Yes.
Oh,
which was
yes.
a
Another great toy.
cheap Mattel rubber astronaut that I loved and played with. He had all the playsets. One of the things Major Matt Mason had was a backpack that you could string a line through his backpack, somehow work the string
Yes.
through, and have him zip line across your living room.
Yep.
Bring up here and
Just
with the
down he
string
goes.
going through his backpack. And man, that worked about twice. And then it got hopelessly tangled. But
Right.
I have not thought of that in decades.
I
Yeah.
just remember his elbows coming through as you if you moved his arm too many times, the wire,
Right.
the armatures would punch through the thin rubber.
Man, I
Yeah, it
kept
was a
one.
very different type of construction for that figure. Yeah, heavy wire,
Yeah.
like twice as thick as a coat hanger, armatures underneath, and then full rubber. But he was far more poseable than any other figures of the day.
He was
Yeah.
great. I kept one in my my drawer. I had a drawer, desk drawer that I kept into adulthood. And one day I'm digging out of the drawer and I find my Major Matt Mason more or less melted into a puddle. The
Oh,
chemistry of the
yeah.
plastic had just he just disintegrated. He dissolved into just this goo. And I was so sad and disappointed.
I had the laser cannon that would fire these they were like cones of twisted foil paper, and if you twisted it and squeezed it, you'd wind up with a small bullet shaped thing, and you'd put it inside the basically the breech of the cannon, and if you closed it and then pressed the button, it would expand, and Newton would take over and fire out the front of the cannon. You have this paper projectile flying everywhere, but
Fail safe.
I lost the. I don't know what happened to the laser thing, but I think every once in a while I come across the piece of foil paper that used
little
to be a laser.
My favorite of the Matt Mason toys, for whatever reason, was the Space Crawler.
Ah, yes.
Little, you know, sort of a cockpit thing, and then has these
they're
wheels,
cups,
but like,
really.
Yeah, they were just arms. So you imagine like if you had like a five-spoked wheel and they took the wheel off.
Right.
And so those would rotate, and but you could send that thing over almost any surface.
And they kind of alternated, so that he's just rocking back and forth, you know,
exactly.
Left to right, left to right.
You know, I haven't looked at it in a while, but I swear for the last maybe pushing 20 years, Tom Hanks has had a Matt Mason movie project just kind of quietly attached to him, like forever in development.
I think you're right.
I wondered whatever was going to happen with that.
Yeah, and who would play Sergeant Storm?
Somebody very flexible. That's all I mean, know.
You got to have your NCO up there. That's the
thing. Yeah, exactly.
It's a beloved toy. There are people making modern reproductions of them, and I haven't bitten on that yet, but they're out there.
It's great stuff.
It's terrible to have disposable income.
Captain Action, so much good stuff from that era.
Wow. Well, I think
Jim. We're not done yet, Jim.
Yeah. Okay. You've got something.
I want to throw ziplining some more. Well, you given the history of ziplining going back to BC, and I'm intrigued by that because I'm trying to imagine what natural fibers would be strong enough to string across a valley and let something heavy slide down it. I mean,
hemp's been around forever, though. I mean, you think
about
but hemp
ropes. Isn't that strong, is it?
If you make it thick enough, I mean, they knew how to make cables. They were building cable bridges and things back in Roman times. So I'm assuming, I think that's one of the problems that we assume that people thousands of years ago weren't as smart as we are.
But they didn't have steel.
They had materials that you could weave things with. And if, rope is pretty strong if you get it thick enough.
All right.
So
I'll let it pass.
Okay,
you just talk about zip lines going across valleys, and I'm thinking.
Yeah, I don't know. Now I don't know how zip lines work when you've got a twist in it. You know, if you got the cable I don't know what you'd call that. There must be a name for the weave between the space between cables, the sub cables. But
I don't know, Jim.
Slide.
If people back then, these thousands of years ago, were so much smarter than us, then where are their podcasts?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
Play me one. Okay. then you'll impress me.
Well, they were all lost in Herculaneum, but they're still trying to work on restoring them with X-rays.
Was there some kind of stone cylinder in Alexandria?
they had the pelican underneath the sink that they'd pull out and put them over on top of the phonograph.
Yeah, now we're.
I think we could argue that podcasts are evidence of devolution,
evolution. We've run out of things to do. Now we just talk about it.
Yeah.
So
give any idiot a microphone. Present company accepted, of course.
Wow. Well, anyway, this is an intriguing, I'm trying to think, we talked all about zip lines and the different characters here. I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this. The Howling Commandos seems to be the only ones that are not going to be cannon fodder. It's like Phillips outside is leading all the other red shirts into okay guys, you try to soak up as much laser bolt energy as you can. But the Howling Commandos being further up the food chain, I don't think are going to get lost.
Well, there is the line at the end of this movie of move, keep your spacing, and I wonder if the spacing is so that the blue magic bolts can only kill one at a time instead of 20 at a time. I also note that by the end of this movie, Dum Dum is the only member of the Howling Commandos smart enough to pick up one of the blue laser magic ray guns and start using it instead of his two-shot shotgun. Dum Dum's no Dum Dum.
He's
figured out
seat.
That this is a better weapon. I'm going to pick that one up, and they're all lying all over the place. Why don't we all take one?
Obviously, a gamer,
I was going to say, and that's one of those movie tropes that always drives me crazy. Is the good guys are escaping, they're fighting their way through, they're shooting all the bad guys. Why aren't you grabbing every gun you can find and every magazine and every bandolier? And when you go into battle, bring a giant bag. And just throw all that stuff in there. I mean, number one, you don't want them staying behind for either those enemies to wake up or other enemies to come along and get them. But it's just, this is precious cargo here.
Bring detonators. You can pick up the TNT as you go along.
Yeah.
It's fine.
But as you said, Jim, I think gaming reinforces that. Because you know, you're a first person shooter, you shoot somebody, the first thing you do, I got to go trot over his body in case something magically pops into my
inventory. Might have a first aid kit and food. Exactly. And, I don't want to get down to seeing my fist coming up in the screen on the first person. I'm down to a fist? Come on.
Wow. Oh, what a time to be alive.
It is. Yes, this is. We are too much victims of pop culture. Actually, we're just aficionados of pop culture. So it helps when you're watching a movie like this. Wow. Well, I think that's all we can talk about with this. But we've got lots of great minutes coming up. But if you'd like to continue talking about what we've been talking about, we'd love to hear your zip line stories. And we're always available over at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook, to talk about stuff like that. If you do like our show, please don't forget to subscribe. Leave a like. I know we ask you this all the time. If you could leave a like at whatever podcast streaming service where you found this episode, it helps people find our show. Also, please check out our great big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.